So hello, this is Mary Beth Hollinger. I'm the Director of Education Support and Advocacy at MITO Action. Many of you know me already, and I'm just so thrilled to have Dr. Kendall here today to talk about, is this really MITO? So many of our community are in that boat without that genetic confirmation, and some of their doctors may question that diagnosis, others may embrace it, and sometimes it leaves the patient standing in the middle saying, I'm not really sure what's going on here. So I just so thrilled with this topic. Again, our slides can be found at www.mitoaction.org. Scroll down a little bit to most recent news and click that first presentation, is this MITO? Is this really MITO? And then that will bring you to Dr. Kendall's page that we've developed. And in the green box on the right-hand side, you can click to view the slides and follow along the slides at Dr. Kendall's pace. You can also get there by going to www.mitoaction.org/blog, and her presentation is the first one on that page. So that's just another way. You can email me with your questions for this presentation for Dr. Kendall, and I'm going to voice all the questions today due to the number of callers on the call and the time constraints that we have. So keep the questions a little bit more broad, and I hope that we can get to as many as possible. So email me at marybeth, M-A-R-Y-B-E-T-H, at mitoaction.org. Or if you're having trouble getting on the call or finding those slides, you can shoot me an email as well. Dr. Kendall, have you joined us?
Yes.
Great. Well, welcome. I truly am so thrilled to have you here today. Just very exciting. So many people have been looking forward to this for weeks. In fact, as soon as we started posting it, they were calling in on Friday saying, is this the week? Is this the week? We're like, no, you actually have to wait two more weeks. So people are definitely very excited about this topic. I am almost daunted to introduce you, Dr. Kendall, because the list of accolades and accomplishments that you have had in the past 25 years is staggering, and I know I just cannot do it justice. So please forgive me if it sounds minimized, but you have been so instrumental, such an advocate for our patients, that I know I can't really do it justice. So I'm just so thrilled. So Dr. Kendall, you can all read through her bio with all of her accomplishments, her Harvard-trained board certification in clinical biochemical genetics. Right there, that is such a mouthful that biology, chemistry, and genetics are all very tough fields, and you've combined them all so gracefully and so powerfully that you have really just become a movement of your own. So just even that part is amazing. Most of us know that you are the founding member of the VMP, which is an awesome way to step into the future of medicine, offering virtual appointments, which is so helpful for a rare disease. You have multiple hospital appointments, board certifications, academic appointments, clinical research fellowships, professional positions, even being part of our own medical advisory board. The number of lectures and teaching and publications, it's staggering. So we just so appreciate how much you have given to our community. So in knowing that our community can read your accomplishments, I thought I would add some that are a little different from what I have heard back from the patients, which is that you are the most passionate and compassionate doctor that they have ever known. And those are two very different things. You're passionate to find the answers, to just keep digging, to help these patients live day to day with whatever it is they have. But you're also compassionate in that you really care, and they feel that. Everyone I talk to knows that you are brilliantly smart, that you think sort of globally. You can keep many of the balls in the air at the same time and make those connections that someone else may miss, as well as that you're willing to go the extra mile for your patients. Many say that your attention to detail and viewing that whole picture at the same time is what makes you extremely unique. And finally, your ability to become an advocate when needed for your patients as well as the whole community, even with medical cannabis or if a child needs a school accommodation, knowing that you have our community's back is something that is hard to put a value on, so we so appreciate it. So Dr. Kendall, without further ado, I will hand it over to you, and again, I will voice questions at the end if that's okay with you, and you can run with it.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mary Beth. I hope I certainly can live up to that introduction. But in any event, good afternoon, everybody. Happy Friday. And so today I'm going to talk a little bit about, when an alternative diagnosis to a presumed mitochondrial disease diagnosis should be considered. And so the first thing I want to outline is just my overall objectives. And of course, I'm going to start by reviewing the approach to mitochondrial disease diagnosis in general. And then I'm going to segue into some clinical red flags that suggest to me that a non-mitochondrial diagnosis should be considered. And I'll talk a little bit about why alternative diagnosis should be entertained and some of the tools that I utilize on a day-to-day basis to reanalyze patients. And I will be doing and making my points utilizing actual cases. And so, of course, due to HIPAA and privacy regulations, there's no identifying information in regards to these cases. But they are actual cases there. And they are a few that I thought highlighted some specific points, but I have many, many other cases, some of which I'm going to mention to emphasize other points as we go through this. So anyway, let me just then segue again into information that most of you in the community are already familiar with, but there may be some people who are relatively new to the community, and it never hurts to just reemphasize some major points just so that we're all on board and functioning from the same perspective. So, of course, as we know, mitochondrial energy disorders are found in about 1 in 4,000 individuals, and that number changes a little bit depending on the reference and resource you utilize, but that's certainly a much greater incidence than when I started in this field in the early 90s. And at Boston Children's, when we thought the incidence was 1 in 50 to 100,000. So that's obviously far more common than we believed in the past. So there's also an important point. There's a carrier rate of some of the common mtDNA mutations, maybe as high as 1 in 200. Now, this study is now 5 to 10 years old, but it was a study done out of the UK where they looked at newborn screening samples and analyze them for some of the common mtDNA mutations. So those are those maternally inherited mutations. And they found them in as high as 1 in 200 individuals. Now, there's been no other studies on that data, to my knowledge, that showed whether all those individuals developed clinical symptomatology, which I doubt they did. Or they may develop it later, of course, as well. So they may carry, for example, a MRF mutation, but they may not come to clinical presentation until much later. I just saw several patients with MRF who did not present until well into adulthood. So again, they may not have any clinical disease at this point in time, but it's still interesting from a broad perspective to know that these mutations are potentially far more, have a far greater impact than initially anticipated. Now, of course, mitochondrial energy disorders are caused by an alteration in our inherited blueprint, our gene mutation, or they can be due to a toxic effect of external factors such as medication. Now, for the emphasis of this discussion, I do not get into any of the external factor toxicity issues, such as metformin toxicity or the medications, but certainly they do exist. They do cause problems for patients, but my focus is really on primary mitochondrial disease today, those that actually alter a specific gene or genes and result in mitochondrial disease. Now, again, as we all know, mitochondrial energy disorders result in decreased energy production and a broader cascade of biochemical findings in the cell, which I won't go into, but it results in localized or widespread problems in multiple organ systems for affected individuals. Now, the next slide, which is my fifth slide, slide for those of you trying to follow along here, outline some of the more common problems that those of us in mitochondrial medicine see on a day-to-day basis. So, of course, particularly in the children, you have a lot of central nervous system or brain problems. Now, not that the adults don't struggle as well, but, of course, the earlier onset in the kids will often translate into developmental delays, including autism, certainly neurodegeneration or loss of function, seizures, muscle pain and weakness. In adults, a common problem I see is ptosis, which is droopy eyelids, and CPEO, which is an acronym for chronic progressive external ophthalmoplegia, which is why we say CPEO. But that means people can't look up, down, or sideways due to eye muscle weakness. And then, of course, hearing loss. Some of the other things we see, again, primarily in the kids, failure to thrive in short stature, but adults can also have cachexia or extreme weight loss and issues surrounding that. Chronic fatigue occurs very frequently in both adults and children. Gastrointestinal issues are very widespread, and it can range from things like chronic constipation to far more severe dysmotility, resulting in TPN dependence, and even liver failure in some subsets of mitochondrial disease like Alport's syndrome, for example. Autonomic dysfunction is again, a very, very common problem that I deal with all the time, and that can cause a temperature instability. Many people with mito overheat quite readily. They can also have irregular heart rates and blood pressure problems. So when they get the cardiovascular issues, that tends to be more significant in the sense that sometimes they need other interventions other than just cooling vests and those type of things to help manage those symptoms. And then certainly you can see endocrine problems like diabetes and hypothyroidism. And while I don't see it that frequently, things like cardiomyopathy and heart rhythm abnormalities do occur as well. Now, the next slide talks about the diagnosis of mitochondrial disease. And so for those of you who are been in the community for a while and are familiar with these diseases, and certainly if you've gone through the process yourself, you recognize that this is not an easy diagnostic journey. So if you go into your physician and you say, I think I have diabetes, for whatever your reasons, you have a family history, you're losing weight, you're urinating a lot, it's relatively easy to sort that out. People will check your fasting blood sugar and something known as a hemoglobin A1C, and we'll know whether you have diabetes or not, and that's kind of the end of that kind of journey. But in terms of mitochondrial disease, we typically have to use multiple tiers of testing. So usually the first diagnostic clues are the constellation of clinical findings and features, and the hallmark of that is multi-system problems, and you're all probably familiar with that terminology. So that means things that are seemingly unrelated and affect wide swatches of the body. So if somebody comes in and has a lot of central nervous system problems and then has cardiomyopathy and then muscle weakness an enlarged liver that doesn't work very well, that unusual constellation of findings is often the first clue. And then we will use, again, a number of different tiers of testing. Biomarker studies, they look for abnormalities, biochemical abnormalities in the blood, urine, and cerebrospinal fluid that can be out of whack in mitochondrial disease. The thing to keep in mind, though, is that not all patients with mitochondrial disease will have elevated lactate or any of these other abnormalities, for example. But many do, but not everybody does. I happen to have an adult patient with MELAS, and for those of you who know that disease and that acronym, part of the disease description is elevated lactate levels, and she's never had any elevated lactate levels, and she's got the mutation, and her mother had the mutation, and so there's no question about her diagnosis, but despite even the name of her disease, she does not have elevated lactate levels. So had somebody just looked at that, that would have been dismissed. So again, biomarkers are very helpful, but they're not always 100% diagnostic. Radiographic studies, we utilize particularly in the kids with developmental delays and seizure disorders, and you can certainly see things like white matter disease, in Leigh disease, for example, there's very distinctive symmetrical lesions in the brain, usually affecting parts of the brain like the basal ganglia and the brain stem, so some of the motor coordination and vital function centers. But that's not a particularly useful tool in adults for the most part, but again, it can be very helpful. The exception to that is MINGI, which again is another one of our famous acronyms in mitochondrial medicine, but those individuals with that subtype of disease usually have white matter disease. So then the remaining studies we have are a combination of functional testing and then gene testing. So functional testing is referring to enzymatic analysis of the mitochondrial electron transport chain pathway. So that's what muscle biopsies are and what they were utilized for. So again, we're looking and measuring that biochemical pathway. And then, of course, gene testing, which took a backseat to muscle biopsies for many years just because we didn't have such advanced tools that allowed us to look at such a broad spectrum of genes. But that has markedly improved in the last, 5 to 10 years, that's kind of eclipsed muscle biopsies as your kind of go-to diagnostic tool. And then, of course, the last categorization that I have listed here in terms of how to evaluate patients is utilization of published criteria, such as the Bernier criteria. Now, there's a number of diagnostic criteria out there. They're relatively old, meaning they haven't been updated recently, but they're at least 10-plus years old. But what these criteria do is they try to assign points to various aspects of findings in mitochondrial disease to give you some sense whether or not you think this patient definitely has mitochondrial disease, probably, perhaps. There's a little bit of gradation there. Now, that, again, can be a little bit problematic, but it certainly helps us, particularly in cases where we feel perhaps that you have mitochondrial disease based on some, maybe not definitive findings like an actual gene diagnosis, but you have some other things. And we as the mitochondrial clinicians can refer to those criteria to say, yes, listen, I understand this patient doesn't meet all the criteria, but they probably have a mitochondrial disease based on utilizing these published criteria. And that certainly helps in some cases where you're dealing with other physicians who are perhaps skeptical about a diagnosis. Now, one thing that I tell folks all the time, and sometimes I need to do it when I see patients myself, is that before embarking on an evaluation, and again, I should probably say I'm now on slide 7, you should make sure that you screen for other disorders before really considering mitochondrial disease. And so, for example, and most people do have some of these studies done before they present to somebody like me, but sometimes they don't. And so things like chromosome abnormalities or other inborn errors in metabolism or any other disorders that could potentially explain some of the clinical presentation. So, for example, I see a good number of adults who, as one of their presenting symptoms, is fatigue, as it is for most mito patients. But fatigue can be caused by other problems, anything from hypothyroidism to even autoimmune disease. So if somebody comes in and they've not had some screening studies for some of those other disorders, I will make sure I will look at those before I embark on extensive studies like gene testing or again certainly biopsies. So that's just a few things that you should keep in mind before you consider some of this more advanced and complex testing, is to make sure you've had some of the basics looked at. Okay, so having said all of this in terms of, this is mitochondrial disease and these are the common problems and how we routinely diagnose, the true topic today is to focus on cases whereby I've re-diagnosed and what my thought process was in regards to why I felt strongly that these patients had some other diagnosis. So if you go to slide number 8, it talks about clinical red flags, and these are clinical red flags for me. I can't speak for any of my other colleagues, of course. I'm sure at least some of them would concur with many, if not all of these, but nonetheless, these are not published red flags. These are what I have generated and have identified as red flags in my clinical practice. So the first one is if a patient has predominantly a seizure disorder. Now, this can be a little bit challenging because, of course, some MITO kids have predominantly seizures as the big primary focus for their disease process. But we have identified over the past 5, 10 years many, many seizure disorder syndrome gene mutations. So if a child has severe seizure disorder, has had severe seizures his or her entire lifetime, and most of the problems are linked to having severe neurological impairment due to intractable seizures, such as developmental problems, such as brain atrophy on brain MRI, then you really need to think that perhaps this could be a seizure disorder mutation and not a mitochondrial disease. And the next red flag is certainly developmental delay syndromes, particularly if a child has dysmorphic features and they don't have multi-system involvement. So again, many kids with mitochondrial disease will have a host of developmental problems, but with some rare exceptions, they usually don't have dysmorphic features. And for those of you not familiar with that terminology, that means facial features and other body features that are identifiable by looking at them on the outside of their bodies that are different than what you would expect based on their family. So a common dysmorphic feature that we're or common dysmorphic syndrome that we're all familiar with is Down syndrome. You may not be able to tell me in medical terms what the features are in that particular disorder, but you certainly know a Down syndrome child if you come across them. So they're the kind of features that I'm talking about. And then again, without multi-system involvement. So if you've got a child that has some dysmorphic features and developmental delays, but they don't have other organ system problems, it's really purely developmental delays, then you definitely need to think about some of these neurodevelopmental syndromes. The next is isolated myopathy. And so, and myopathy, of course, is muscle disease. And again, many mitochondrial patients have myopathies. There's a subclassification known as mitochondrial myopathies. But once again, most mitochondrial patients will have other features other than just purely muscle weakness. And that can be wide-ranging. And it can be, for example, Kearns-Sayre syndrome has a lot of muscle weakness, but those patients and mtDNA deletion syndromes will also have muscle weakness, but one of which is Kearns-Sayre syndrome. But they often have ptosis and ophthalmoplegia and even other body system problems. So having said that, again, mitochondrial patients often have more widespread body system problems. So isolated myopathy should be a red flag. The next is a static disease process. So even though mitochondrial disease can have a slower smoldering course, as I describe it to some of my patients, meaning they progress over time, but it's not a rapid progression. If you're looking at a patient who's had absolutely no changes over years to decades, then you always have to, again, this is a red flag, that's considered a static encephalopathy or just even a static disease process, meaning, again, they're extremely stable. Maybe they have a little bit of muscle weakness, but nothing else and nothing else got worse. Maybe they have some developmental delays, but nothing else and nothing gets worse. So that's when you have to say this is a very static process. Maybe this is not a mitochondrial disorder. Now, the next is no biochemical abnormalities. And so that, to some degree, conflicts what I said earlier about my MELAS patient who doesn't have an elevated lactate level. So you do have to take this with a little bit of a grain of salt, but certainly if I see a patient who's very static in terms of their disease process and they have no biochemical abnormalities at all, no elevated lactate, no low carnitine, no elevated CPK, any of those findings, then again, it does become a red flag for me. And then the last one is the gut feeling of the practitioner. So, you know, that's a vague statement, of course, and I can't really quantify it anymore for you. But just like we all do as parents, as either physicians, nurses, or whatever our chosen profession are, we develop understanding of disease process, and we have gut feelings. Again, it doesn't really matter what your background is in terms of your career, but we all sometimes say, no, I just really don't feel that that's the case. And that's just that intuition based on sometimes some subconscious understanding of things that we just can't necessarily express, but we just know that something's amiss or not quite right. So having said all of that in terms of the red flags that I utilize in my practice, and what I've come to see as findings that make me want to reanalyze somebody, what I want to do is now segue into discussing several cases. And so the first one is slide number 9, and it's a seizure disorder syndrome. So I'm going to talk about the highlights of how this patient presented and what some of the abnormalities are, and why I decided again to pursue some other diagnosis. And again, I have 3 cases that I'm going to talk about, and then I'm going to segue again into some other comments about testing and kind of my approach and what I do. So the first one, again, is a seizure disorder syndrome. So this particular patient presented at 6 months of age with infantile spasms, which is a significant seizure disorder. So at the time that this patient was first investigated for the possibility of a mitochondrial disease, the child had already had chromosomes, lysosomal enzymes, biotinidase assay, a number of metabolic studies. And so everything was negative except for a mildly increased lactate on one occasion. And so just as a quick aside, for those of you who are not familiar with this, lactate, again, is a marker for mitochondrial disease, but it's very finicky in terms of its collection and processing. So it's not it's not uncommon to have some false positives. So that's just, again, something to keep in mind. Now, the other things that this, after these initial studies, this child underwent was a brain MRI and some spinal fluid studies and then a muscle biopsy. And this little one was found to have a complex 1 defect. And so was labeled with a mitochondrial disease. In terms of following the patient, this kid's clinical course was notable for predominant seizure disorder and delays linked, again, to having an intractable seizure disorder and loss of brain matter due to that. So remember, keep in mind, as most of you understand, if somebody's seizing constantly, their brain cannot really focus on learning and developing. And so kids with severe seizure disorders typically have severe developmental problems. But this child had no other systemic involvement. And so I followed her and did a number of metabolic studies, and they were consistently negative, so that elevated lactate that was seen initially was not repeated, meaning it was not found to be abnormal on multiple occasions subsequent to the initial diagnostic evaluation. And so I was concerned, given the clinical course and the findings, that this child may have a seizure disorder syndrome. And so, interestingly, I did a smaller gene panel initially for some of the more common seizure disorder mutations, which ended up being negative. And then I expanded my work up and found that this little kid had a de novo SCN2A known seizure disorder syndrome mutation. So de novo means that it is just in the child. So even though it's genetic, meaning it altered this child's genetic blueprint, it was not inherited or passed down through this child's parents. And again, this is one example, and I have many, many, many examples of seizure disorder syndrome patients that had undergone similar evaluations with biopsies, told they had mitochondrial disease and turned out to have seizure disorder mutations. And most often, seizure disorder mutations are de novo, which means there are no recurrence risks for a couple. And so sadly, I do have one family that they had undergone a biopsy and were told they had, the child had mitochondrial disease, and the father proceeded to have a vasectomy, and it turned out the child had a de novo seizure disorder mutation, so there would have been no recurrence risk had the family elected to have other children. All right, so the next case is a neurodevelopmental gene syndrome patient. And so, again, I'm going to walk through what was initially identified and my particular reasons why I decided to investigate further. So this child presented at a year of age with low tone and developmental delays and had, I think, at least one or two elevated lactate levels. This kid underwent chromosome studies and telomeric FISH studies, metabolic testing, and CSF testing, which was negative except for a lactate of 14 with normal up to 12. Now, just looking at this, that didn't really make it a little bit ambiguous, but it was not the CSF testing that was abnormal. It was a blood lactate that was 14 with normal up to 12. A muscle biopsy was completed and identified complex 1 and 4 defects. The clinical course for this child was that he demonstrated a static encephalopathy, and he had no other organ system involvement, and he had dysmorphic or unusual facial features. And on follow-up on a number of occasions, his metabolic studies were negative. And so because, again, of his static encephalopathy, no other body system involvement, no positive metabolic screening studies over time, I was concerned that, again, he likely had a neurodevelopmental gene syndrome mutation. And indeed, investigation found that he had a de novo. Again, this was isolated to him, so no recurrence risks for his parents or his siblings weren't going to be carriers or anything along those lines. And he was found to have a very rare disease called Mowat-Wilson syndrome due to a defect in something called the ZEB2 gene. So again, this disorder, not a common disorder by any stretch, rare, but it is a neurodevelopmental gene syndrome that's associated with dysmorphic features. And again, it typically has a static course, and that's exactly what this child had. And his clinical facial features were consistent with that disease as well. So the last case on slide 11 that I'm going to specifically discuss in a lot of detail is a myopathy case. So again, myopathy is muscle disease, and again, we have many mitochondrial patients have mitochondrial myopathies, but quite often they will have other findings or features. So this patient presented at about 6 years of age with axial, and so that's core kind of muscle weakness, and proximal muscle weakness, and proximal muscles are those that are closest to the center of the body. So proximal would be hip girdle and shoulder girdle muscle weakness. So his trunk was weak, and then his his shoulder girdle and hip girdle, and did have a couple of elevated CPK levels. Now, in this particular case, he never had any elevated lactate or other markers other than his CPK level. So he had a muscle biopsy at one point, and it was notable for changes that you can see due to a chronic myopathy. Now, keep in mind that when these biopsies are done, of course, we measure the electron transport chain, but we also look at the muscle under the microscope, look at its structure, look for other abnormalities. So in this case, it showed signs of a myopathy or muscle disease, but they were nonspecific, meaning it didn't say, aha, it's this particular muscle disease. And then he had a complex 1 defect. And then, so that he was, again, like the other patients, labeled with a mitochondrial disease. But he had a very chronic, stable myopathy that affected his core and extremities. And he had no other system involvement, and his metabolic labs were also consistently normal. And he turned out, on further evaluation, to also have a de novo mutation. So all three of these cases had mutations isolated to them without recurrence risks for extended family or for the parents, in something called the COL6A2 gene. And it is associated with something called the Ulrich Bethlem Muscular Dystrophy Spectrum of Disorders. So there's a kind of a broader spectrum where they can present in infancy all the way up to, you know, adolescence and older, and it's essentially an isolated myopathy. And so, again, he was confirmed to have a different disease. So these are three cases specifically that were presented with some symptoms that made me concerned that they have another disease, and it turned out in all those cases that indeed they did. Now, just to make it more complicated, the last case I'm going to present on slide 12, it says, even if it really looks like mito, it still might not be, and that's where it gets a little scary from your perspective as parents and families and patients, and even for those of us who are clinicians. So this one was a little bit tougher, but there were some red flags for me regardless, even though this patient really looked like a mitochondrial patient. So this child was 4 years of age when she presented with unsteadiness or ataxia and subsequently developed seizures and developmental delays. So there was some disease progression. So this was not a static case. So, again, that's why it looks more like mitochondrial disease. An EMG and an initial brain MRI were normal. She underwent some ataxia studies for a couple of more common causes of unsteadiness, like Friedreich's ataxia and ataxia telangiectasia, and those studies were normal. So she ultimately made her way to for consideration of mitochondrial disease, and she was found to have a complex 1 defect, although all of her other biochemical studies were negative. When she was 7 years old, she underwent a subsequent brain MRI, in part because she was developing other clinical symptoms, including seizures, and she was found to have cerebellar atrophy. Now, that can occur in mitochondrial disease, but it also occurs in a number of other neurometabolic disorders. Now, with this child, I think the thing that was most telling to me was, in follow-up, her metabolic studies were negative. Now, why was that a red flag for me? Well, this was a child who was progressing or showing some progressive clinical signs. And often when that happens with people, even if their baseline metabolic studies are negative, usually with time, then as their body is struggling and they're showing progressive symptoms, then their cells are often will show signs of faltering. So their lactate, their CPK, those type of markers will start to become elevated, and hers were solidly normal. So as a result, I investigated her further, and I was concerned about one of many different types of of ataxia. So there's many, many ataxia syndromes out there. And she turned out to, and she was, did have spasticity. So again, as part of her progression, she developed some spasticity, and she was found to have an autosomal recessive form of spastic ataxia affecting the SACS gene. Now, of course, in this case, this was an inherited disorder, and both of her parents were identified to be carriers. So there were recurrence risks and carrier risks for her siblings and recurrence risks, of course, for her parents as well. So again, this is a difficult case because by all means, it certainly looked like a mitochondrial disease in terms of progression and both clinically and based on brain MRI, but again, it was not, there were some hallmarks to me, particularly some of the metabolic studies that made me concerned that perhaps I really did need to look for something else. So here's four cases, three that exemplify some very specific points, meaning seizures or isolated myopathy, and the last one is, again, a little bit more challenging. But if we go to slide 13, and I have just a few more slides, and then I guess we'll have some time for some questions, but what are the implications of the correct diagnosis? And I just wanted to emphasize this, in part, not so much for most of you. I think when you go through this process and you're dealing with chronic disease, you understand that. But I've certainly had patients who've had physicians tell them, well, what does it matter? Well, in my opinion, it matters a lot. And here are some of the reasons why having the correct diagnosis and why continuing to look for the appropriate answers is important. So the first comment is it allows for implementation of appropriate treatment modalities. And that's kind of a no-brainer, again, for those of us in this community. But keep in mind, you know, they're not that there's necessarily a cure-all for, definitely not for mitochondrial disease or for some of these other disorders, but there can be some appropriate treatment. Now, one case that I didn't present today, but I will bring up, is a young girl who had initially presented with hypotonia, and she had had a biopsy and was told she had mitochondrial disease, and then kind of got lost to follow-up because she was relatively stable. But she came to me after, as a young adult, after many years of, again, not really being in the community, as a college student. And she had developed a movement disorder. Now, again, mitochondrial patients can have movement disorders, but there was something about her presentation that made me concerned. And I determined that she did have a movement disorder, and she happened to have a treatable movement disorder. Had she been treated much earlier, she wouldn't have had to contend with the clinical symptoms and the problems she had been dealing with for many, many years. But nonetheless, she was found to have a treatable disorder, and appropriate treatment was implemented with improvement. So that's the first point. The second is it prevents unnecessary interventions and testing. So not that I routinely do follow-up studies on my mitochondrial patients to monitor things like lactate and those type of things. And even at times I'll do brain MRIs or other studies depending on the patient and their clinical symptoms. And while they are not overly aggressive or invasive, it's still interventions and testing. And so if you don't have a mitochondrial disease and you have a static disorder that doesn't require specific monitoring on a yearly basis, well, then you're undergoing unnecessary interventions and testings that are not required. The next is provides eligibility for clinical treatment trials if they're available and you're eligible for them. But again, most people in the community know that for the most part, with treatment trials, you have to have a clear-cut gene diagnosis. And certainly if you have some other disorder and perhaps there's treatment or clinical treatment trials available for those, if you don't know you have the disorder, then of course you're not going to know that you're eligible. The next is it provides accurate prognostic information. So, again, being classified as one disease and thinking you have that disease versus having something else that has a completely different outcome is extremely important. The young boy that I described with the myopathy, when he was discovered, he was a very, very bright young man, and when we discovered he had a different myopathy, he said to me, now I can think about my future. So this boy had spent his entire young life believing that he was never going to make it to adulthood. Now, he's going to have problems with his myopathy, but he is going to survive his illness, and he will thrive through it. So that obviously is an incredible moment for that young boy to have the opportunity to understand he had a full life ahead of him. So, of course, accurate prognostic information is clearly and obviously important. And then the last point that I made is it allows for accurate recurrence risk for subsequent pregnancies and other family members. So, again, as you noted through the four cases that I presented, three out of the four were de novo or isolated to the presenting patient, which meant for their parents, their siblings, their extended family, there was really no issue. Now, there's something called germline mosaicism, which I'm not going to get into for the purposes of today's talk, and that can make people face a small risk. But, you know, a genetic counselor or your geneticist would talk to you about that. But for the most part, these are de novo, again, which means there's not going to be a recurrence risk. And that has huge implications for families considering other children or even siblings who, you know, they're maybe as they get into their own reproductive years, wonder, you know, what it is, what kind of recurrence risk they would have or what they would have to worry about. So if it's de novo, of course, they don't have to. Okay, so if we go to slide number 14, what are the diagnostic tools that I utilize for the purposes of evaluating patients? So it's very, of course, it's similar to what I investigate people on the front end, but I'm just going to talk a little bit more about it and bring up some points. So, of course, genomic studies are out there. So genomic is looking at our genetic blueprint, and there's a whole host of gene testing that's available to us. So we can have isolated gene testing. If as a clinician you're concerned about a specific disease, you can look at that one gene. You can look at, there are panels of specific genes, so there are neurodevelopmental panels out there. And then there's more broad testing like whole exome or whole genome testing. Now, the one point I wanted to bring up about the genomic studies is just to be careful about the word whole in terms of whole exome and whole genome. That doesn't mean that 100% of people or 100% of genes will be evaluated, and that if you walk away from that test, there's no way you couldn't have a genetic disorder or a mitochondrial disease even. So let me just bring up a few points about that in terms of my personal experience. So whole exome sequencing looks at about 3-4% of our genetic blueprints. If you look at some of the published data, they talk about 35-40% of people walk away with a definitive diagnosis. Another 35% or so, in my experience, are found to have candidate genes, which means they're genes that are highly suspicious, but we don't have the medical information now to say they absolutely do. And then the rest, of course, are we just don't know. We just didn't find anything that we can hang our hat on. So, again, the point is that it's not 100%. Now, keep in mind, there was a study this summer, at least the information was relayed this past summer, 2017, where a research group looked at a number of mitochondrial patients who had negative studies like exome, mtDNA, those type of things. And they found that 10% of the patients they evaluated turned out to not have a problem in their genetic code, but in the actual transcription and translation of that code. So remember, think of your genetic code as a blueprint for a house. So you might get a blueprint that looks perfectly fine, but if the general contractor takes that blueprint and instead of your kitchen puts in a garage, then that was a problem after the code. There was nothing wrong with the code. It was just the way they interpreted or the way it was transcribed and translated from there. Then the last things, of course, in terms of re-diagnosis or clarifying are biochemical tissue studies and metabolic studies. So, again, biochemical tissue assays have kind of taken a back burner to the genomic studies, but keep in mind sometimes they're necessary because those genomics are not 100%. I have a case of a child who I was strongly suspicious had pyruvate PDH deficiency, pyruvate dehydrogenase deficiency based on a number of findings. And the child had undergone some gene testing through an institution in New York, and it was negative, and the family was told, no, that she doesn't have this PDH deficiency. So I reverted to basic biochemical studies like we used to do 20 years ago, and indeed she does. And so, again, there's a number of diagnostic tools that I use to either initially classify or reclassify patients. Okay. And the last comment I want to bring up, again, I want to leave a few minutes for some questions, is who arrives at the diagnosis. So this is slide number 15. Couple of points is labs do not diagnose patients, clinicians do. So that's something to keep in mind. So especially with these advanced genomic studies, you can get a report back that says you have, you know, a variant of unknown significance, which is the bane of all of our existence in terms of these vague findings. But it's not the lab who's going to determine if that's diagnostic or not. It's the clinician who's interpreting the data. So I'll give a quick example of how that impacted a patient. I had a child a number of years who came to see me for mitochondrial disease evaluation, and I thought that the child had something called Cornelia de Lange syndrome. So something I had seen during the course of my training and time in Boston in particular. And so I did a couple of the common gene mutation studies, looking for the common genes, and lo and behold, they were negative. And so I said, well, I don't know. This kid still looks like Cornelia de Lange. So I did some additional more extensive studies, and I found a variant in a very uncommon Cornelia de Lange gene. So that gene caused the disease in less than 1% of the patients. So my point is that it was a variant, but because the child had every clinical feature seen with this disease, even though it wasn't, you know, documented as a clear-cut mutation, I, as the clinician, said, this is the cause for this child. So it's the clinician who's going to make that final diagnosis. Now, if something is clearly pathogenic, of course, most physicians are going to utilize what the lab tells you, but there can be this variability, as we know. And the last thing is really the clinical experience and acumen of the doctor does matter. Now, you know, again, you know, a comment is we're not all the same, and that's based on our experience. So keep in mind, if you came to me and you asked me how to treat colon cancer, well, I'm just like you. I can Google it and tell you something. I can certainly temper it with my baseline medical knowledge, but I'm not an oncologist, and I wouldn't be the best choice to go to for that issue. So having said that, when you're looking at rare disease, you're looking at mitochondrial disease, you need to go and see somebody who understands that subset of medicine. And that's critically important for many, many reasons. And I see many patients who come in from all over the country, and I do international consults as well, and people are labeled with and told they have certain diseases based on whatever studies that were partial studies or not even appropriate studies. And, you know, they just, the evaluating physicians really didn't have the experience to and didn't know the diseases. And so you have to be aware of that, because that can have a profound impact, and people can walk around with the incorrect diagnosis for many months to years, again, if they weren't evaluated by somebody who really understands the disease. So again, there is a reason for subspecialists. Just like I said, if you came to me for cancer counseling, well, I would advise you not to, because I certainly don't have the knowledge base to do something like that. So they're the points I wanted to make today. I know this can certainly be overwhelming to some degree, particularly from the perspective that in a community that often gets targeted for child medical abuse or fictitious disease, having anything that kind of shakes that foundation a little bit and having one of the specialists say, wait a minute, you may not have the disease. This is really, can be a little disconcerting, but as I indicated, this is not about anything other than making sure that people have the facts, they have treatments available to them if they are available, and that they have the right diagnosis. I'm not wedded to a diagnosis, I'm wedded to the right diagnosis. So thank you all very much for your attention today, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this topic because it is an important one, I think, and I have, you know, again, I presented a few cases today, but I have probably 50 to 100 cases on my desk that I've re-diagnosed, and so it is an important topic for the community. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to entertain a few questions before we finish for today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Kendall. That was a very informative presentation, and I'm getting many comments through email with people thanking you and just saying they have learned so much just from listening today. And I do think you bring up very good points about seeking the right diagnosis and not feeling sort of owned by a particular diagnosis or feeling like that will be a loss if that diagnosis changes because you really didn't belong there anyway. So hopefully people can sort of disassociate from the diagnosis and just view the person, whether it's a child or themselves. And
that's
correct.
And
I also love your point on the gut feeling. Because I think many parents have those same gut feelings, so they understand that there is some value to a parent saying, I know my kid just doesn't look right, there's just something off, this is my fourth kid or my second kid, I kind of get this. And then saying that, yeah, the doctors have those same gut feelings that, you know, they need to trust as well. So I think just so many awesome points. I could go through the whole thing. We do
thank you.
Many questions. And I know.
Oh,
go ahead.
I just want to bring up a couple of things, Meredith, to enforce things. So for me personally, you know, again, I know that parents and families get anxious, but in my practice, for example, I know in other places, if they do some, say, for example, gene testing on somebody who had a biopsy and it's negative, some people are taking away the diagnosis. I don't do that. I don't take away a diagnosis unless I have something to replace it with. Now, I'm not saying if somebody comes into my office and the only thing wrong with them is a hangnail and somebody told them they had a mitochondrial disease, I'll tell them I really don't think you have that. But in terms of, you know, if you've got a kid who's got a seizure disorder and developmental delays and the only thing that's been abnormal to date is a biopsy, I won't remove the diagnosis. I might continue to look as tools expand, but I won't remove that diagnosis. So for my patient population, personally, they don't have to fear, and I always tell them that, and they know that. The patients that I follow know that I will not do that if they do, because some of these biopsies, you know, and I didn't get into it, but, you know, it doesn't mean that the biopsies are always incorrect. It just means that they may have been detecting some secondary abnormalities, but they're not the primary cause for the child or the adult's problems.
I just think that point of a more correct diagnosis can bring you better therapies and treatment, more effective, has to be shouted from the rooftops because that's a huge difference.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I have so many questions, and I actually know we are not going to get to them all, so I will tell the community that I will answer any of these questions that came to me after the fact. Give me a little bit of time, and
okay.
I can maybe ask Dr. Kendall for a few tidbits on these questions, but we will get back to you on that. But there are a few that did stand out to me, and this one comes up very often just in my phone calls. We all know that, you know, genetic testing is now coming to the forefront as it becomes more accurate and sophisticated. How accurate and comprehensive is genetic testing for mitochondrial disorders?
Well, it does have its limitations, and I've seen different data, but, you know, some people, like some of the labs, will report that it's only about 60% of gene mutations are identified. And again, I brought up that study from this past summer where they looked at a bunch of patients who didn't have a gene diagnosis, and they're like kids with Leigh disease that clearly had mitochondrial disease, and they're showing that there's other abnormalities, meaning it's not necessarily the code, it's another point. So, but that's the data that I've seen, 50 to 60%. And that's in part why we sometimes have to use multiple different tiers of testing. And sometimes I have to hold on to different things like, okay, this person has chronically elevated lactate, but their DNA testing was negative, but they have a neurodegenerative course. Well, you know, that's probably mitochondrial disease. So it's a good question because, again, in a world where people are like, okay, you don't have a gene mutation, then you don't have it, you can't really say that with 100% accuracy and certainty.
Okay, that totally makes sense. Another person is asking how far out you are booking appointments, because I think that with you just listening to you today, you may be getting a plethora of calls.
it depends on the time of year. Of course, at the end of the year, when everybody met their deductible, we get slammed. Because genetic testing, they have copays and that kind of stuff. It varies. It's usually a month or two. Sometimes we'll have, you know, people get sick, of course, and they have to reschedule or cancel an appointment to a later time. So sometimes we even have openings as soon as a couple of weeks. So it just really depends. You know, when you're calling and what we might happen to have. But generally, we can get people in. And if there are certain emergency situations, and I don't want to, I probably shouldn't say that, Mike will probably kill me, but you know, we can try to make accommodations for people as quickly as we can.
Yes, and the cost, I know, is just dependent on too many factors to get into on this call, but
yes,
they should call you for more information about that.
Yes, yeah. And Mike will be happy to talk to them at length.
Okay. This one is interesting. From a slide that showed the common symptoms,
mm-hmm.
The caller wanted to know if there was like a certain number that you needed, like they referred to an ADD scale where you needed 10 points on a scale, you know, in order to be diagnosed, and they wondered if anything of the kind was offered for mitochondrial disease.
It's a good question. I don't think so, but I'd have to pull up like the Bernier criteria. It's usually multi-system problems. So if it's like two or three, you know, organ system involvement or two or three of these features, that's usually what most people consider enough to consider like a multi-system process.
Mm-hmm. And do you have time for one more?
Sure.
This one came in. What makes for a strong clinical diagnosis for those who cannot afford genetic testing?
What makes a strong clinical diagnosis? The things that are probably, and again, it sometimes depends on the patient, meaning if it's a child or an adult. But certainly if it's a child and they have a neurodegenerative disease, that's certainly worrisome, and again, if it's a kind of a multi-system problem, so for example, if they have a seizure disorder and they have progressive developmental, you know, a regression of developmental skills, and then they have, for example, liver disease or liver failure or progressive liver dysfunction, that would be like a big red flag for Alper syndrome, for example. So in children, that's the kind of clinical feature. Now, of course, even if folks can't afford genetic testing or they can't get it covered, usually you can get some basic biochemical studies. So, you know, if you have some of those markers as well, then that's helpful. And then in an adult, it's a little bit more challenging in adults because some of the chronic features are things like fatigue and autonomic dysfunction, and that can be caused by a lot of different things. So, for example, if somebody has an autoimmune connective tissue disorder, they may develop secondary, autonomic nerve damage and then have symptoms similar to mito. But some of the things that I find in adults in particular that are big red flags are ptosis and certainly ophthalmoplegia. So if you've got really droopy eyelids and you don't have myasthenia gravis, you don't have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, you don't have those things, and then if you develop external ophthalmoplegia, they're really good clinical symptoms. And certainly, again, as an adult, if you have a neurodegenerative disorder, some of the first mitochondrial diseases back in the 40s when they were first described, 30s and 40s, were actually in adults who had neurodegenerative disease. And so, of course, they're not the things that anybody wants clinically, but they're some of the big red flags from a clinical perspective. But, you know, again, keep in mind that that's reflective of the more severe case scenarios. And so those signs alone are going to miss people. But there are some of the things that people can look at to say, okay, this is more likely than not.
Mm-hmm. And there is that big distinction between the children and the adults, which is quite frustrating to the adults. But I tried to tell them, you know, think of a 50-year-old car. It's had a couple car accidents. It drove through that deep puddle. It can have little sort of stressors on so many levels that are giving out all sorts of symptoms, whereas a baby is a little bit, that history is so much shorter. It is sometimes a little bit more clear cut to get to the root of their issues.
Right, and that's a very good descriptive analogy to use. And the other thing is as well is that most often the adults are at least in part functional. And so what I mean by that, and that's not meant to diminish anybody's symptoms whatsoever, but adults, especially if you're a parent and you're worried about you're taking care of your kids or going to work to put food on the table, you kind of will dismiss things for a long time. And so, or it might start to come to, you know, your concern, but you go in to see a physician and you say, I'm always tired. And they say, well, you're a parent and you work a lot. So things will get dismissed because in part you do continue to function at some level. So that's the other problem with adults. A lot of times people don't take some of the adults seriously until they're so, so impacted that they're, you know, they're so far along in their disease process. That it's sad because they didn't get any relief or assistance up until they really present with significant problems.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's very true. And they have a special place in my heart for the adults because...
Yeah, they do. They do. I do think that they struggle more because they don't have that, you know, a parent is a bulldog advocate for a kid, whereas they don't have that kind of, you know, they're doing it on their own.
Very true. Well, I know that it is after 1 o'clock, and I so appreciate your time and the depth of your presentation. I know it'll bring up a lot of discussion, and I hope it opens some eyes so that if someone notices that maybe they haven't had progressive symptoms or, you know, aren't quite following that mito pattern, that maybe, you know, there is another answer for them that could bring them a lot more relief.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I so appreciate it. I know our community is cheering for you, even though they're on mute. Again, thank you for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Okay, folks, enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you for your attention and interest. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.